This is Gamer Footnotes, semi-pretentious thoughts about gaming, and I'm JT, along with my fellow host, Steven.
Yeah. Hello, everyone.
And I just wanted to remind you that our web address, as always, is gamersfootnotes.com, and because we're OCD, we have the S's after each of the words, even though that makes it harder to remember the URL. And luckily, Gamers Footnotes with the S's again is in front of our Gmail address if you want to send us an email and let us know your thoughts on the show. We're really excited about this show and our upcoming shows because we're talking about a subject that is on the hearts and minds of gamers of a certain age. And I'm going to let Steven here kind of explain that in more detail.
We've seen, especially through Penny Arcade, but also through other sources, a lot of discussion in the last couple of years, fairly recently, about gaming and its relationship to art. There are a lot of people who have weighed in on this, perhaps the most famous from the kind of anti-side being the late, great Roger Ebert, who consistently claimed that games weren't art. Of course, many gamers don't care one way or the other because video games are video games. But it has become more interesting to sort of see what we might call artistic video games that really seem to be trying to not just tell a story, but to tell a story in a certain way, or games that play with the medium, or even games that really do very interesting things with art. And that's been going on, of course, for years. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the word, but there have been games that have used watercolor, such as, again, can't pronounce the name, but a game about a wolf from Japanese folklore and then using paint to sort of overcome obstacles. Or to a lesser extent, if you prefer, Epic Mickey, the games that involve using paint to have Disney characters overcome obstacles. And so there are all these different ways that interactivity plays in, various different elements. And so we're going to take some time to address, it's really such a big topic, to address specific points from art to direction to perhaps the interactivity portion of it. But today we thought we'd start with maybe the most obvious of the artistic forms in gaming, going back even to before there were graphics, going back to the text-based adventure games, and that is story. Video games generally, with some notable exceptions, at least attempt to have some kind of story to a greater or lesser degree. Square and the Final Fantasy games, of course, made their entire nature about story for a number of years. And we see that, though, even in every genre. The Call of Duty games frequently have some sort of conspiracy or some sort of governmental action that is a story about how some world event is playing out. Oftentimes, especially in first-person shooters, they're actually related to real-world events and history. And so games can be political commentary, which can also be an art form. And so story, I believe, is sort of the key point on which the rest of the elements of the game are frequently built. Everything else is sort of directed up from that point.
And I think that's a very interesting point, and it's sort of, I'm curious on going back, and let's start with, I think, on a timeline approach, where I think it's interesting you mentioned games like Zork, the original text-based type games on the PC, where it seemed that story was first and foremost.
And only, in some sense.
True, and that became kind of the point of the playing, was to unlock more story. Whereas on the console, it seemed like in the early days of Nintendo and Atari, the story sort of became the rewarding mechanism. So like take a game like the original Mario Brothers, where the reward was to get to the castle to save the princess. And then you find out that, you know, she's in another castle and developed your lifelong hatred of Toad for teasing you. And that's a whole different subject. But it seems that it's kind of interesting when you look at the way that console games like Mega Man, for instance, had a story. I mean, there was a subtext about robotics.
And really, in some sense, it's interesting to mention the old games, Mario and Mega Man, because they spawned sort of, at that point, it was about developing your own story. They had kind of the basic elements, and I don't necessarily recommend anyone search Mario fan fiction. You may end up in some weird places. But I promise that there was a lot of story that was developed around just the concept of finding the princess in the castle.
And I think that that's kind of an interesting point, because a lot of people think, and I think a lot of gamers think, that it's the game that entices them to the universe. But they've made a billion Mario games because they made likable characters telling relatable stories. And I think it's interesting to see the evolution of graphics into story. So you took a game like Zork, for instance, that was all text-based. So it was all choose-your-own-adventure sort of adventure. And that almost immediately evolved into what was called at the time adventure games before it got subverted in modern times, are now point-and-click or parser-based games like King's Quest or Space Quest, which did tell a story. And then it sort of developed this hybrid approach that I think is where games have yet to get out of as an evolutionary standpoint, which is how do we meld the interactive portion of a game with the narrative that you want to tell. And one of the things that I think is kind of a classic example is the original TIE Fighter on the PC. Because there is a huge subtext to the game that you are the evil empire. But gamers don't like to be the bad guys. And at the time, it was sort of this revolutionary idea of what if you did play a well-known villain? I mean, you were a TIE Fighter pilot killing innocent rebels who just want freedom. But they added a sort of a nobility to that on how they guided your character through the missions. And part of it was that there was an Imperial Civil War, so that, you know, there was times where you were fighting the Empire and there's times you were fighting rebels, and it sort of talked about the gray of it. And, I mean, that's always one of the things that kind of stuck with me about TIE Fighter, and why I think it's a tragedy that Lucas and Disney now haven't re-released it, is to sort of see that point in history where people could look at something that you wouldn't think would work on paper, but added sort of a nobility to that through the storytelling.
And so that's a great example of how storytelling really does form kind of the basis of the game. My evolutionary example would be, for anyone who played the old MUDs, Abyssal Realms was my MUD of choice. Those really were the precursors to modern MMOs.
I think there's a lot of modern gamers who may not know what a MUD is, Stephen. So if you would just explain that briefly.
Fair point. A MUD was essentially a text-based game that, if you've ever seen references to, you would see a text description of a game. You played through a client, ZMUD, I think is still alive and well. I think they still have these. And you'd read a description and it would list, you know, the exits to the room, and you could type in commands. Imagine, if you know anything about modern MMOs, that your entire game was played through the slash commands, the emote commands. That is effectively what a MUD was. And so you would read it and you would go up or you would go down, or you would say attack the slime, and you could play an entire game this way, and we did. And really, even they had a story. Now, sometimes the challenge was divining what that story was from the short text blobs, but it was there, and it kind of set up how we still tell stories in MMOs. Until very recently, it was generally done through the quest text. Well, that is basically what a MUD was. You were reading blurbs that were effectively quest text. And now we had, again, there's been some change in this, but MMOs, you basically got the story by reading what it was you were supposed to do and inferring the rest. You were supposed to go collect 6 rabbit spleens because this person needs rabbit spleens to prepare for the war effort against the Alliance. In deference to Blizzard Activision, I don't believe I've ever actually picked up a rabbit spleen, but almost every other animal part in existence. Now they've moved a little bit more towards having these overarching story arcs for entire expansions, especially in Blizzard, where we have, they tried not to do it with Mists of Pandaria to a certain extent, but for Cataclysm and Wrath of the Lich King, of course, it was all about Deathwing and the Lich King respectively. And so there's a little bit more backdrop to the story now. But originally there was mostly these sort of text blurbs. And so in some sense, the text part didn't actually change. We really did just build graphics around a text story, and the graphics changed how we interacted with the game, but they didn't really change the fundamental delivery mechanism, for lack of a better term, of how we got into the story. And so that's always been sort of a fascinating example to me of how text-based things still end up in games, even though now sort of the industry standard for most things is voice acting or very short one-line, you know, blurbs from delivered by individual characters.
And I think that's it's an interesting point, because a lot of times story, when you read story like about a novel or stories in a movie, one of the words that critics would say of those genres is immersion. How easily can you believe the events you're reading? How easily can you believe the events that you're seeing? Do you feel that you're a part of the universe? Do you feel that you relate to these characters? Do you feel like you understand their motivations? Playing on basic human emotions like empathy. And video games have had kind of the way I see it, struggled with that specific aspect because of the technology medium that they're using, because they require more audience participation. So, and as gamers, we have to acknowledge the fact that we get a certain perverse pleasure out of breaking games. So, in the original Mario Brothers, if you could have shot the princess with a fireball, how many of y'all would have done that? I'm willing to wager everybody would have tried it once. So, as a game creator, it sort of becomes hard to tell a narrative, because the person that's experienced it has such an impact on certain elements.
And one thing that kind of goes with that is, when we're talking about story, you know, one mechanism that's used to drag people in is to make them feel like they are one of the characters. And that oftentimes can be story immersion or art immersion. It can be a lot of different things to make you feel like you are that person. But another way that it was done that was much more story-driven, when you look at, say, Final Fantasy VII, you were attached, even though you weren't really the characters in the sense that you are the protagonist in the BioShock games. You were kind of controlling them, but you were outside of them. Even so, the story made you feel a great deal of empathy for Cloud's mental problems, and Ares, of course, was being set up for. And yes, anything over 10 years, you're past the statute of limitations. For the pathos associated with her death, these were ways to get people involved. And really, in Seven, it was the story. It was the setup for these characters. It's why Ares had to be in your party so long, was so that you really got a feel for what you were going to lose.
And I think that's an interesting point, because a lot of times gamers, and we'll talk about some different genres in a minute, but associate story with being a central pillar to RPG games, whether they be on the computers, whether they be from Japan, whether they just be American emulation of Japanese RPGs. And, you know, you've really see game developers struggle with essentially three different viewpoints, as I see it, which is... The first one is, like Steven alluded to in Final Fantasy VII, is the older I get when I go back and play it, the more I realize that you are more or less the Fates. That these are characters who exist outside of your ability to manipulate them, but you as, and I'm hesitant to say God because that's one of the overtones of the games, but you as sort of the whims of fate and chance are guiding these people, and they're sort of, for once again going to religious overtones that I shouldn't, you're sort of their shepherd, and they are sort of your flock. And you, part of the pathos and the empathy you build towards them is that your actions, in some ways, create their harm. So you sort of get that sort of touchiness to them, and it's kind of like you develop a friendship with them, but you have more of a direct impact on them. And then the second two, I think of most... interestingly been described in the Dragon Age series, where you're a first-person perspective, but in the first game, which I really enjoyed, you more or less were you in that universe. You had the Gordon Freeman-esque, you never said anything, even though you could pick dialogue choices, it was never shown to you, but it was directly implied that you were controlling these actions, and your motivations were your character's motivations. Contrast with Dragon Age 2, which I disliked, and setting aside the technical problems with it, one of the reasons why I disliked it is I felt as a separate person than Hawk was. That he was he was his own character with his own motivations, and how he viewed the universe wasn't necessarily how I viewed the universe. And sort of my feelings towards his family and towards his comrades could have been different than his feelings.
And so those are both different ways that we approach video games, and they play out in very different ways through the story. Because when you have some kind of a cast of characters that you're controlling, The story resembles much in a movie, because while the game is still interactive, the story is not necessarily as interactive anymore. In some sense, it's kind of on the rails. And that's why they, Square, going to keep writing that Final Fantasy VII example, but in any of those types of games, they can kind of tell a story. And their goal is to tell a story in which the interactivity is used to make you more empathetic to the cast of characters, but other than that, it's still kind of a movie. Whereas a lot of times when you are the character, it kind of does something very interesting, and the games I'm going to use for this are going to be BioShock. When you are the protagonist, not some other guy, but you are the protagonist, and you have a backstory, but it's still ultimately you that's doing it, that kind of takes it in another more interesting direction, because a movie can tell a story, but really kind of takes a video game to make you a cast member in the story. And yes, it's still kind of on the rails. There's still the one story they're trying to tell. Maybe there are multiple endings, but basically it's that one story. But it adds a lot more psychological value to the twists and turns of the story when it's not happening to your cast of characters, it's happening to you. You feel the sense of betrayal more keenly. There is a classic moment in BioShock, which is not quite old enough for me to comfortably discuss, but essentially the plot twists actually affect you as opposed to just affecting a cast of characters. And so that's just an interesting way that video games can sort of interact with the concept of story and make it not you watching a story of someone else that maybe you can relate to actually in some way acting out your own story using the prompts from the director, who is in this case the creator of the video game.
And I think that's an interesting point in, we'll take a game that we can talk about freely, is Deus Ex. I think Deus Ex, if you look at it, I mean, objectively, it's not, the game mechanics are good, but there's games that do almost everything it does better. I mean, there's better stealth games, there's better RPG games, there's better inventory management systems, there's better dialogue choices. But it's the story that's compelling. It's you as JC finding your place in this universe that is kind of interesting, because here you have an established character, but he sort of suffers from the same problem that you, the gamer, have in your emotional state, is you have no idea what this world's about. You have no idea who you are or what you are. But the exploration of Deus Ex is you make that determination for JC. You decide what kind of person he is. Does he help his brother? Does he fight his brother? Does he believe in the power of authority? Does he, you know, try to subvert that power of authority? And ultimately, as Steven says, these games all put you on the rail because you have to advance the plot. But one of the things that was kind of unique about Deus Ex is you could easily dead-end your game based on people you killed at certain points. I mean, you could more or less end the game before the game even got started in a way, and that was always interesting to me. And I think that's part of the problem that we see almost in the sequels, especially for Deus Ex 2, is you didn't have that same level of exploration, that you didn't get that emotional investment into the character or why he was suffering. And I think a lot of times, story not only just provides you a motivation for what these actions are, but it binds you to it. It gives you that emotional investment. I think the next big classic example is a game like Portal. I mean, Portal and the puzzles are fun, but after you've done that four or five times, you kind of have a sense of what the puzzles are about, and you kind of understand the solutions and the basic physics. But it's the fact that GLaDOS is just sitting there taunting you, that you feel this emotional investment to beat her and prove the superiority of humanity towards her.
And that's, I think, another example where Portal 1 had a story, but it was a lot more about you kind of inferring the story. Really, very few directives. It was just this robot taunting you the whole time until, of course, the very last part where the dynamic changes a little. Whereas Portal 2... especially through the framing device of Wheatley, had a lot more of a sort of direct approach to story. This was about piecing together what happened between Portal 1 and Portal 2, and trying to, and even long before Cave Johnson was added, best video game commercials ever, And they, so it was another case where Portal 1 sort of had a story, but it was kind of more about, sort of like the old Mario games, about kind of putting the story in the game based on the prompts you were given, whereas Portal 2 had more of a directed story. Both were, I thought, excellent games, had excellent stories, but even within the same series, they were really kind of two different examples of how you could approach telling a story.
So which one did you like better?
You know, honestly, I think I liked the puzzles in Portal 1 a little bit better. But Portal 2 had such amazing environments. Because it wasn't being done just as kind of a fun tech demo anymore. Something to throw into the orange box for the heck of it. Portal 2 really had a lot of the rundown factory and all of that I thought were excellently created, and I loved the story. I loved Cave Johnson and trying to figure out kind of how Aperture went from a research institute to what it became after post-GLaDOS. And it's always, of course, I thought the humor in both games was, a lot of times humor in any art form, in any medium, can fall flat, and really Portal hit on a great way to do it. And so humor was a major component of how they wanted to tell their story. This was... these were darkly funny games, which there aren't too many of those in the grand scheme of things. They tend to either be serious or over-the-top funny, think Monkey Island. And this one managed to be darkly funny. Those moments where probably shouldn't be funny, but it kind of is, because ultimately, this person is talking about murdering you just constantly and actively trying to accomplish that goal. And it's hilarious. And that's sort of procedurally awkward, but it works. And so I really appreciate kind of that attention to the story in the game and making it either be it through giving you just enough to fill in the blanks or by kind of keeping you on a rail as far as the story goes. In both cases, they managed, it was about the presentation, and the presentation was done quite well.
And I like to just add, my favorite Portal moment is the companion cube, and I still have intense feelings of guilt when I killed my companion cube. But it was sort of a funny stroke in the relationship between story and gameplay, is that you could sit with the companion cube forever and not put in the incinerator, but you couldn't advance. And I think it was a genius on the developer's part that no matter when you put the companion cube into the incinerator, GLaDOS tells you that you did it faster than anybody else did. So then you always had that doubt as the player in the back of your mind was there some way I could save the companion cube? And yet, rationally, you know there's not. But every time I go back and play Portal, I still sit around and think about it. Like, how can I save the silly metal box with the heart on it that it never has any line of dialogue?
And the truth is, and I'm worried this may be a screen for sociopathy, I was the opposite. I didn't care. Like, whatever. It's a cube. We're gonna throw this thing in the incinerator and we're gonna get out of here because this is about me. And so that hopefully will not be used by any listener as a screen for personality type. I don't think I would have done that to a human character, but then that was, of course, entirely the point, is the value of the... Ultimately, if you want to apply kind of a philosophical point to Portal, none of these things exist, and so you shouldn't care about any of them, but you do care about the character, so why don't you care about the weighted companion cube? And obviously, some people apparently did. I don't find that creepy at all. But in my case, I hadn't built that relationship with that, and they taunted me for it. And that, too, is part of storytelling and immersion, especially, and pulling people into the idea that, you know, you were thinking about this as a video game. You should have been thinking about this in terms of you are a character in a game universe, and you just did this horrible thing, or maybe not, depending on how much value you assigned to the weighted companion cube. So that's just another example of a fun way that a video game can play with immersion in a way that a lot of other media can't, is you can have these moments where they trick you into thinking that you're just playing a game, and then they hit you over the head with the reality of what, at the very least, your character has done through you, and make it that much more personal, because that then raises the question, well, would I have done this were this not a game? It opens the dialogue to what would I have done in a related situation where I'm trapped in a giant maze with a psychotic killer robot, which I know I worry about frequently.
Well, this has been good for me to know, so now I know never to be in the same room with Steven in an incinerator, or else I might find out how hot that actually is at the bottom. But I kid. But one other thing I'd like to really talk about in all seriousness about Portal is I think one of the elements that gets left out of the true genius of Portal is a lot of gaming gets rightfully knocked for telling the story of basically white men. These are all white men in some form of action. Even the Final Fantasy games. Cloud, Tidus, white dudes. Go back to, you know, 4 and 6, still white guys. Made by, you know, Japanese people, but they're still telling fundamentally, even though it's from their cultural norm, the main characters tend to be white guys. Now, whether setting aside all of that cultural implications, one of the really interesting things about Portal is the very first time you glimpsed in the portal, because you don't see a mirror, and you realize you can see what your character looks like by the portals, and then you realize you're this girl. And so that was a very, I think, bold choice at the time to make sort of a minority-type character. And, you know, she has a, you know, once again, a vaguely ethnic look to her. You know, some kind of, you know, thing. So you're not telling the story from the usual cultural norm. You're telling a new one. And I think you're now seeing games having the confidence to break that. And I think the best example recently has been the Walking Dead games, where you're telling a story from a completely different viewpoint, and you're adding in sort of this tension. And I mean, I feel comfortable saying this to the internet, is as a white guy now playing the story in The Walking Dead, and I look at Kenny, I felt at times that Kenny looked at me sideways or judged me based on my race, which was, for me, a new experience, because that doesn't happen to me on a daily basis. But, I mean, I felt through the game they kind of tackled racial issues, not necessarily as boldly as they could. But I think you're starting to see that integrate into games.
And I think a lot of The Walking Dead was a throwback to, or not a throwback, but was Night of the Living Dead is often credited as being, as revolutionary as it is, either the first or a very early zombie movie, depending on what you want to call zombies. But for anyone who's not aware of this, the original Night of the Living Dead was almost entirely a allegory about race in America. And the main character, Sidney Poitier, the quintessential survivor and the only competent person in the house, who was African American. And so you have this in, you do see this in The Walking Dead, but it's also interesting in that he is a criminal, and you're really kind of led to believe maybe he really is a criminal. Like, you know, it's never explicitly said, maybe he was wrongly, I think a lot of people want to feel like, oh, well, he was wrongly accused, but you're given enough information to suspect that while he may have had reasons for what he did, he really did commit a crime, pretty serious crime.
And I think we should delve in that for a moment, because it's strongly insinuated and implied, and I think almost flat-out stated, that he killed his wife's lover. And the game begins with you going to jail for that. And you sort of have this police officer who's taking you, sympathetic, but in a very artificial way. And then it sort of kind of evolves from that point. Now, one thing I will talk about The Walking Dead a little bit that I did find disappointing on what was truly a masterful game is I made the decision not to take the supplies from the station wagon. So the entire end of the game really fell apart for me because it didn't make sense for what the pseudo bad guy thrown in the last chapter's anger at me was for, because I wasn't really involved in that, but that sort of brushes up against the on-the-rails problem of gaming.
It does, and a lot of that game was on the rails, but it was still, I think it's some of its greatest achievements were using even things like controller vibration and the position of the screen to make some of the more physically gruesome scenes that much more horrifying. There's one scene in particular that, apologize for the spoiler, but essentially, for various reasons, the character you play loses a limb.
Did you choose to chop off
the arm? I did choose to chop off the arm. And part of that is you actually... It was one of the only times I've ever played a game where it was physically hard for me to continue going, because any time you moved that saw, the controller... I was playing with an Xbox controller. The controller vibrated and the character screamed. And I actually, for me, got physically... not ill, but physically bothered. I could actually feel slight nausea in the back of my mind, because you could almost feel it. Not to in any way imply that I know what it's like to lose a limb, but at the same time, they really did an excellent job of invoking, largely through story. Now, that's of course the meeting of story and the technical functions of the controller and graphics and dialogue and acting. That was a confluence of everything, but it was ultimately the story itself which allowed me the empathy to care about any of those other things.
And I kind of want to delve into this for a second. What made you decide to do that?
Well, that is the story, which is, I guess I have a background in a loosely related to medical field. And for me, if you have an infected limb, you don't have access to medical treatment, your best option is to not have that limb anymore. So for me, it was sort of, and that is sort of where the immersion breaks down. It would have been probably harder for me to make that decision if it were my arm. But because I did have the barrier of it being my character's arm, it was not easy for me to make the decision, but easy for me to see the rational basis for making that decision. And so it's just enough separation to not change that the impact of the moment, but to make me wonder, well, if I've got adrenaline pumping and I'm looking down at my arm, would I maintain the ability to make that kind of rational decision? I'm not sure. And we're not necessarily to the point yet where we can know, but that was sort of the basis for it. Is I knew intellectually that if you're dealing with disease, a bloodborne disease, or what you suspect is a bloodborne disease, you're better off without the arm.
Well, and when I came to that moment, I also chose to sever the limb, and I did not make a scientific decision because I have no such background. But to me, it was at that moment I accepted that my character was dead. That no matter what I did, no matter what actions occurred, he was not going to be saved. And then at that point, every decision after that became what was the best thing for Clementine.
Physically saved. Just have to throw that in. Because
sure.
It's very much a story about saving the main character. More so than most of the other characters, in fact, I would argue. But that was the moment where you kind of realize, like, you're not surviving the zombie apocalypse. Which that was playing with, is the goal of these zombie movies to survive the zombie apocalypse? And frequently it isn't. It's to keep your humanity intact until you objectively fail to survive the zombie apocalypse.
Which I think brings an interesting point, because the ultimate salvation of the main character is saving Clementine. So I think Steven's right that you continue to sacrifice your physical body for his emotional, philosophical, spiritual salvation. But moving on from the somber into sort of a quick back and forth questioning, have you ever played a game that was not fun to play, but you had to see how the story ended?
Oh, yes. Now, the best example of that for me is one that would get me hate mail, but I'm going to use it anyway. I loathe the combat system in Final Fantasy XII. I think it is absolutely abhorrent. I actually found it physically painful to grind the mobs in Final Fantasy XII. It made me sad. I needed to know, for people who aren't familiar with Final Fantasy, most of them are set in different worlds. There is a subset of them that is all in the same world called Ivalice. This is one of those. Final Fantasy XII was set in that world. And I needed to know what happened to the characters, because I really enjoyed the story much as I loathed the combat. I am in fact trying to go back through Final Fantasy XII right now, because my joke has always been if I wanted to play World of Warcraft, I would just go play it rather than trying to do it through a Final Fantasy game. And right now I am doing the beta for Final Fantasy XIV, which is an MMO, and I thought, well, hey, while it's down, since I'm already in the mood to play a Final Fantasy MMO, I can go play Final Fantasy XII. And that has finally been the impetus I need to force myself. I've still not finished Final Fantasy XII. I've finished every Final Fantasy game in existence that I'm aware of that has a number after its name. except for Final Fantasy XII, and I am finally going to find out what happened there, because it has always bothered me that I do not know how Final Fantasy XII ended.
Have you ever stopped playing a game because you didn't like the story?
Huh, now that is... I'm cheap enough that if I've bought a game, I'm probably forcing myself through. I honestly can't think of one. I feel like it may have happened, but I probably blocked the entire experience from my memory. Have you gotten halfway through a game and quit because the story was just that bad?
Dragon Age 2.
Okay, well, there you go.
I love the first Dragon Age, but I got... This got... And part of it's because the story was so bad. But when I got... Have you played Dragon Age 2?
I have.
I got to the part where you get through the catacombs, kind of about, I think, halfway through. And then you end up losing your sister, who at this point was my most powerful side character. And so my Final Fantasy VII rage kicked in, and I was like, you took my healer.
Yep, that can be a problem. I will say that I like... the Dragon's Age games have an interesting mechanic in how they interact with each other that kind of almost makes it worth getting through them. But at the same time, I think 2 is generally considered to be the weakest, or at least it was for me. I enjoyed 1 and I enjoyed 3. And then I think I skipped 4 through whichever one came out on the PS2, which I did play. But those games... Especially back when we're talking about, in a more general sense, about the old JRPGs, they show the same evolution. Final Fantasy I, you are largely making up the story. The main story points, there are only like half a dozen main story points in Final Fantasy I. Essentially, all you need to understand is you're attempting to save the world from some guy. Be it Chaos or whoever it ends up being. I guess that one's definitely past the statute of limitations on spoiling, but... Suffice to say that originally the name Final Fantasy did actually make sense. It hasn't since the first game, as far as I'm aware. But then we started seeing more and more. Now, I will disagree about the Final Fantasy being just about... Final Fantasy VI, I would argue, is a story about Terra, who is a white woman, but not a white man. But it did take them all the way to VI to have kind of that protagonist. But the Final Fantasy games are sort of a study in the evolution of storytelling, taken from the perspective of sort of the hands-off approach, where you're really behind the character, what you call kind of the shepherd approach, where you're behind the characters, but you're not the characters. In some sense, 1 was the closest you came to being the characters, but that was really because they kind of lacked their own personality. They only existed to carry out your orders. They were all the Warriors of Light. They had no individual traits to speak of. But past that, then you got to, especially once you start getting to, well, really anything past 1, there was a story. And that's sort of associated with JRPGs, I think, that there is going to be a story. And in 10, in 12, in 13, one of the big complaints about 10 and 13, I know, was that it was very on the rails. And that's fine. It's still about progressing through the story. And so we see the evolution there. But I think what the more interesting evolution was when games branched out into doing things like BioShock, where you are the protagonist and your decisions have some sort of impact. Or even in complete sort of open world sandbox types things like Skyrim, where you're in some sense forced to invent parts of the story as you go. And each one of your characters may have a subtly different story. Still on the rails for the main story, and there are still only so many options. But if you were really interested in role-playing, maybe you do the assassin quest, but not the warrior brotherhood quest. And so you develop a character who that character's story is much more about creating how that character... That's an interesting question, because I have done this. Have you ever refused to do a quest because you didn't feel like it fit with what your character would do?
I think all the time, and... The best examples I can think of are the Fallout games, because Fallout's one of the few series that gives you a lot of options on what quests to take and new and exciting ways to refuse quests. But the first Fallout always had a place in my heart because, you know, I refused to take the Slaver's quests. And that was something I thought my character wouldn't do. And then Fallout 2, you sort of see that evolved again. And my character spent way too much time in New Reno cleaning up the streets from the scum and the hive of villainy. And it sort of became this moral dilemma of, when do I ally myself with these certain gangsters in order to take them out? And then when do I betray them? And that, I fully acknowledge, was a complete metagame occurring in my head behind the game. But that all the options were there to do that. What about you?
I have, absolutely. And especially in the Fallout games are actually an excellent example that I hadn't really thought of. But they are almost entirely a morality play to begin with. How far will you go for survival? What are you willing to do? What are you willing to give up? That kind of thing. And they do a good job with it, simply because your decisions do seem to have some sort of an impact on what's going on around you. And so I would ask myself, well, would this character actually do this? And there's a much bigger, like, starker dichotomy in the original Knights of the Old Republic games, where, you know, there was good and there was evil. What's interesting about the second Knights of the Old Republic game is you had the neutral character Kreia in the background criticizing your decision either way and explaining how good and evil is not as easy as the obvious, that there's often more beneath the surface, that doing something that seems good may actually ultimately cause more harm. And that again shows sort of this move towards, you can tell a story, but you can also make kind of almost in a sense chastise the player for their decisions to drag them deeper into the story and remind the player that while, you know, this is just a video game and entertainment, it's very distant for them, that if you really buy into it, this is a character, this is a person, this is someone. And reminding the player from time to time that those decisions are important to this fictional character can make the player even more responsive, I think, to what those decisions are in the first place, to the point where you're sitting there thinking, can I do this for this guy? I mean, yeah, it'll get me some extra money and that'll be great, but would my character do that? And that's where it really becomes a role-playing game in the truest sense of that term, because you begin to play the role of this this character who's almost entirely of your own creation and who no one in the world but you probably cares what they do, but it's still important to you. And that is really one of, I think, the higher forms of immersion, is when the character has finally become not just an extension of yourself or something you control, but their decisions have actually become moral dilemmas for you in the greater context of how you make those decisions.
And I think Knights of the Old Republic 2 is an excellent example, and I do have to disagree with you that Kreia is a neutral party, because I think the crux of Knights of the Old Republic 2 is about whether or not you can maintain hope. That while you do get criticized for your good and your bad decisions, Kreia represents the person who's given up hope. That good, bad, evil, it's all kind of indifferent, because the story all sort of ends up the same way. And I think that was sort of an interesting point to me, that in Knights of the Old Republic 2, in the first one, the story was about redemption, whether or not Revan could be redeemed, or whether or not you chose to want him to be redeemed, or whether or not falling to the dark side was his redemption in an odd sort of way. But I think 2 was much more about whether or not you could still maintain your hope in light of the sins of the world, which is sort of what the Sith Lords represented in a different way. But that leads me to a question of where I think story in games especially comes down to this, is whether or not you can talk to a third person and articulate a viewpoint about the game.
Well, and it's all about shared cultural experiences. That was the great advantage to television. Was suddenly, movies to a lesser extent, but it was really television and the proliferation of American television that created sort of a wide set of shared cultural experiences. Oh, did you see what happened on X? And then you could talk about that. And in the background, there was always the subtext, not just of what happened in the show, but the relatability of that situation. Because these things, whether we realize it or not, these things only work if the situation is believable on some level. If we can, even if you're talking about science fiction, or you're saying, well, that's not believable at all. Yes, but the characters are. They have to be. You have to be able to get to the point where you think, oh, gee, that was a moral dilemma for Captain, pick favorite Star Trek captain here. And so they have to be relatable, especially, actually, I would argue even more so when the story itself is fantastic. The characters, then I'll use Game of Thrones, which has a video game, technically, don't buy it. But also a television show and a book series. Even though these characters, you know, most of us probably are not feudal lords of one kind or another, the characters themselves and the situations are relatable. They have to be. And that's very true in how we tell stories in video games. The situations have to be relatable. Even more, you want that immersion. That's the whole point. Is you want to drive people to keep going, to be interested in the story. Take a series. Take Mass Effect. If the story had fallen flat in the first one, and you couldn't convince anyone to care what happened with Commander Shepard and the intergalactic threat, then the gameplay in Mass Effect is good. I don't know that it's great. It's sort of standard third person over the shoulder shooter fare in the second and third games. It's all right. It's definitely not why I was playing those games. I wanted to know what happened to Commander Shepard. I wanted to know what happened to Earth, and that's all about immersion. That's all about story, and how that interacts with gameplay is vitally important. I'm certainly not going to argue that it doesn't. But what got me there, what made me forgive the sins of it being an EA game in the first place and having day one DLC, was how much I cared about that story.
And just kind of one final question on the story. Doom. Does Doom have a story? The original.
Yes. Again, I would submit that it's largely player created, and that's a design decision. It is possible to just give the building blocks. You could argue, is the story important? I think story can be more or less important within a game. Story is a driving factor behind some games. It's maybe the backdrop to provide the context for what you're doing in others. But even a game like Terraria, for anyone who's familiar with Terraria or Minecraft or any of those, I could certainly make the argument they have a story. It was not put in by the developer, but it is very easy to sort of... I think humans just by their nature have this need to contextualize things. And one way we contextualize things is to add a story. Why am I on this very blocky world? And so, at the risk of becoming metaphysical and almost borderline nonsensical, those games have the opportunity to really pull out the philosophical questions. Why am I here? What am I doing? Why does any of this make any difference? If I make a fortress entirely out of jungle blocks, was that just so that I could see if I could do it? And isn't even that kind of its own story? The story of, can I do something? That can be its own sort of very minimalist story, but a story all the same. And in that sense, Doom actually does have a story, and I know the story of Doom. There's a portal, there are aliens, you have to kill them. The story was really in about survival and, your skill at surviving something. And from there, you might say, well, why am I this good at shooting things? You kind of, I think, even subconsciously sort of build up this sort of little narrative around yourself. Do you use it for every play? Do you make decisions about which demons you should kill? No, it's not that kind of story. But there's still the elements of story, the elements of even the interaction itself being the telling of a story about survival. And so I think that it's fair to say that might be an extremely minimalist story, but I would still call that a story of a type.
And I think that pretty much echoes my thoughts, and I also too know kind of the story of Doom. But I think it amuses me because that's one of the games people say don't have a story. It's there.
And it could. And that's really part of art. Look at paintings. They are certainly art. And you'd say, well, they don't really have a story, especially, if you're looking at ink splatters on a canvas and some kind of modern art. But I think art theory would say, no, there is a story. The story of the creation of the painting is a story. The story of the artist is a story. And yes, the story of what it's meant to evoke in the person watching it, which may vary entirely person to person, is a story. And there's even a story in how different people will read more or less into the art. That itself tells a kind of story. So is it fair to say there wasn't a scripted narrative? Well, okay, yes, there are games without scripted narratives, certainly. Minecraft. But it may be a person-to-person basis, it still has the elements to evoke a story.
And I think that's a good place to kind of leave it. And I think that's a pretty interesting discussion. And now we're going to switch over to where each of us share one random thought we had based on our adventures in gaming. And I'll go ahead and start off with mine. And I play MechWarrior Online as sort of my relaxing game because shooting other big giant robots from my big giant stompy. And yes, I know they're battle mechs, not really robots.
Thank you.
Set aside Battletech fans, please don't crucify me. But shooting something with an AC-20 is a visceral response that I can get behind. And for all you non-Battletech fans, that just means really big gun. And one of the big problems that that game has is that the developers are very bad at communicating to the community. And part of the problem is because the community blows up over every little response they get. So the developers have done the very human response of just shutting down. And I think that speaks more into sort of a greater idea of game communities and game developers need to have better communication. If you say you're going to release something but you can't for various reasons, just tell us. I mean, we're usually, yes, there's going to be people who are going to blow up over it, but good communication is always the better choice. Sort of in our professional lives, communication is the most valuable asset. And so once you kind of learn that you have to be good at giving both good news and bad news, things go much better than just always trying to give people good news, which is very unhuman reaction. But I think a lot of times, especially with MMOs where the game is constantly in flux, game developers are much better served by hiring a couple of people just to relate to the community. And I'm not talking about Sunshine Pumping on the forums or White Knighting, but I mean just honest-to-God communication of this is what we're working on. This is working well. This isn't working well. This is how we kind of see it going. Because a lot of times for MMOs or persistent online games of various sorts, is you're asking gamers to devote time to it. You're asking them to become invested with either money or time or effort, and you sort of have an obligation to communicate back to us. And then conversely, gamers, we have an obligation to them not to completely melt down over every little thing. And that to try to put ourselves in their shoes on knowing that ultimately, yes, they may be trying to get money, but they're doing what they think is best. And that they're not all greedy and out to get us, setting aside EA. Just kidding.
Communication is obviously vital, and I think some companies handle it better than others. I will say that I understand sort of the plight of the community manager in that announcements, I think absolutely those need to be communicated. We're doing this. This isn't going to work. Those sorts of things I think are sort of obvious. Yes, you need to say something. On the other hand, it is entirely the gaming community's fault that soon became a trademarked phrase of Blizzard Activision. You can't promise anything. You just can't. And I think one thing that's important for companies that are just now sort of breaking out, I'm thinking here of Cryptozoic, who obviously they've been, Cryptozoic makes physical trading card games, and they've been doing that for a long time. So they have plenty of experience dealing with the community, but I don't think their forums have had as much work for them before Hex, their new online trading card game. And so now they're dealing with people from the internet. One thing that I kind of would say to them would be, you need to make announcements, and I think they've done a decent job of it. You need to make announcements. It is not necessary. If you do not have a dedicated 30-person community management team like Blizzard Activision, you do not need to be responding to very many posts at all from people, because the simple truth and reality of the matter is you cannot make everyone happy. So you need to make your announcements and you need to do things, but I do understand the natural inclination to not engage in a lot of threads because the engagement isn't necessarily going to be productive. I mean, if it's correcting a misrepresentation or a misunderstanding, that's one thing. But if it's just talking back and forth, that oftentimes won't. I really have seen many times where that doesn't get you anywhere.
And I think just kind of adding on to that is I agree that back and forth is unproductive because it's not a democracy. We don't really get a vote per se. But I think what game developers suffer from is they don't share their vision. And they don't explain, they're not to, and I think this is why it's appropriate for a story episode, they're not telling the story of their development.
And I think that's one thing that Chris Roberts has done an amazing job with for RSI, for the, for anyone not familiar with Star Citizen, go check it out. If you like internet spaceships, it's the game for you. But they just did a 24-hour live stream, and that's what I'm actually going to talk about a little bit today for kind of my segment. So we'll go ahead and use this as a not-so-subtle segue. They have done, Robert Space Industries and their entire team, they have done an excellent job doing just that, communicating vision. They recently just came down off of their second 24-hour live stream where they set up cameras all over the office. The one in the Austin office was on a blow-up doll for a substantial part of the time I was watching it. That was a little awkward. Don't know what was going on there in Austin. But, you know, these things happen. The ones that mattered, though, we got to see an interview between where Chris Roberts interviewed Richard Garriott a little bit. If you don't know either of those names and are over the age of 18, you should be ashamed of yourself. But suffice to say, some sort of giants in the kind of old school gaming universe. And there have been posts from Chris Roberts, from the designer of this game, a guy who I grew up with through the Wing Commander games, where he has said, this is my vision for the game. And he's even occasionally, nicely, been a little bit blunt about, I'm making a game everyone will enjoy, but the vision is his. And he's always been pretty clear, like, well, I'm not modifying my vision. My vision is, you know, this is, I'm the director, I'm the captain of the ship, I've kind of got to go the way I'm going to go. I respect that, because whether a developer says that or not, that's what's happening. And I thought that was a very interesting way to communicate, this, I'm going to do it my way, let me explain to you what my way is and why I think you'll be excited about it. And there's been a great amount of community. I'm not saying they listen to the community. They do a good job of that too. The community does have an impact on the decisions that are made. But it's so important to communicate that vision, that guiding principle, sort of the, for you know, Americans, the constitution of the game, sort of the boundaries of what shall and shall not be done. That's of vital importance. And there really are just all these posts and all these threads where people have responded and spoken to exactly what that is. And I think that helps. I think it makes it where, you know, there are still forum posts about, oh, well, they should do this, and yeah, okay. And there will be back and forth agreements on that, and who knows if anyone reads those or not, or if anyone even should read them. But one thing that makes it less important to worry about those questions is that we know what the guiding principles of the game are. They've been very upfront about it, and if it's really just not something, if you just have a visceral, total disagreement with it, at least you know that going in, and maybe don't linger here. But if it is something you're interested in, then it just makes it even more exciting. Every time they just released a new website, they're releasing some apps, they're kind of doing, as is often the case with Kickstarters, a phased release where they're going to do a dogfighting alpha and things like that. And it just makes you excited about it to see not just the vision stated, but the vision realized. And it really kind of is its own form of storytelling, of the story of the creation of a video game. And that's what was so fun about this live stream, is it's just sort of another, not a retrospective how a video game is made documentary after the fact, but actually sitting there and watching people talking about how they are making a video game. And you get a sense for the scope of how many people are involved and things you may know intellectually, but that you can't really appreciate until you're actually talking to the people who are involved. And so I really enjoyed the live stream. I really enjoy how they have presented. You can't see me, but I'm wearing a Star Citizen t-shirt right now. Very excited to be a part of that process, and in terms of funding, and to get to watch that process through these sort of events that they've done.
And I think that's fantastic. And the only thing I want to really echo onto that is I do carry my Star Citizen card with me on a daily basis on the one day when I get emancipated into the Star Citizen universe. And I think we're both proud backers. I haven't followed it as closely because I'm treating this as if it was Wing Commander 5 and I know barely anything about what was going on except one day it will arrive and be glorious. And, of course, when the alphas actually do come out, I'll weaken and read everything I can because that's just me.
Well, in the for our story episode, one interesting tie-in is as they have released news feeds from their fictional universe, their goal has been that they're happening kind of in real time. And so the lead into the game is a multi-year, you know, reading the events that are happening up to launch. And that's another interesting way. You can start telling the story before there's even a game to have a story about through these political intrigues in the United Earth Empire and who's doing what and these natural phenomena. Recently, fairly recently, a moon collided with a planet, and there's all sorts of fallout from this this scientific event, which has spawned conspiracy theorists who believe it wasn't a scientific event. It was all a plot to destroy a planet. And so it really shows both story and immersion, because you have exactly what would happen if this, you know, you would have the conspiracy theorists, you always have the conspiracy theorists. And it's all about creating that story, creating that narrative, and then you'll fill in your place in that narrative, but they can really provide the backdrop for it.
Which is really interesting, because, as Steven just said, you can provide your narrative, and they have a whole subform dedicated to fan fiction, fan art, for you to already develop your character that you will play in the game inside the universe as these events unfold, which is completely fascinating and well worth watching if you have any desire to play a Wing Commander-esque game. And I think that's going to do it for this episode of Gamer's Footnotes, Semi-Pretentious Thoughts on Gaming. I'm JT with
Steven.
And we bid you adieu for today, and we shall see you next time as we continue our series on Games as Art.
Have a nice rest of the day, Internet.